Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 35 of Season 4 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan rom-com When Harry Met Sally, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off this week is Duncan Shields of the Time Bandits Minute and Chronologically Speaking. Welcome Hello. Back to the show.
Thank you for having me back. It's lovely talking about this film.
Yes, it's so much fun. That is true. So yesterday we ended things during the conversation between Harry and Sally, and today's minute begins with Harry asking a question and ends with an older couple seemingly trying to outdo one another. So, you know, yesterday we had Harry and Sally walking through Central Park, talking about various things about possibly becoming friends. And Harry is somewhat taken aback by what Sally says to him at the end about, you know, that he sees her not wanting to sleep with him as a character flaw. And he thinks for a second and goes, what's the statute of limitation on apologies? And she says, 10 years. Oh, I can get it in under the wire. Because, you know, obviously we know that approximately 10 years since they spent time together, it's right. Obviously more because, you know, their trip took place in the summer, and now it's clearly the fall. So it's, right. It's a little more than 10 years or whatever.
Yeah.
We once again still get the piano music, you know, coming from Mark Shaiman of It Had to Be You. And then Sally does something very strange. She looks over to Harry and says, would you like to have dinner with me sometimes? Which I think is great that they're showing that she's taking the initiative here with this friendship.
Yeah.
You know, because she's the one who has been fighting against Harry for the last 10 years. You know, in every conversation they've had, she's trying to fend him off. And at this point,
I love that bit on the plane where she's trying to remember Billy Crystal's name, right? To Joe, right? She goes to what's Billy Crystal's name in this movie again?
Harry Burns.
Yeah, Harry. Oh, of course, my God.
No, she can't remember the name of Amanda.
Oh, Amanda Peel or Amanda Pete or whatever she says. That's just as she's, but she remembers Harry's name and but she has trouble remembering it. And then when he was like, oh no, that was it. Yeah. He says, who is your friend in college? And she's like, Amanda. Gosh, I can't believe you forgot her name. When like she made a big deal about forgetting her name. She's already trying to like, you know, pretend to be something she's not, but there is an authenticity and a real honesty to her asking him out for dinner here. And it's almost like an echo of him saying, you sound like you're in a really healthy place.
Yes.
She's like, maybe I'm healthy enough to ask you for dinner. Like she's climbing up the ladder to like, I'm going to try this. It's good. Yeah. I like it too.
And then he responds and says, are we becoming friends now? And she goes, well, yeah. He goes, okay, great. A woman friend. And then he looks at her and he still has to get the digs in. And he goes, you know, you may be the first attractive woman I've not wanted to sleep with in my entire life. And she looks at him and goes, that's wonderful, Harry. So you can see that, well, first of all, Harry is a little taken aback by the fact that she's asking him to be friends.
Yeah.
You know, he's not really sure how to, you know, how to take this. You know, because you know he's an adamantly against having women as friends, and like here she's the one bringing it up.
Yeah, and like you know, I'm sure because this conversation happened so much earlier in the film, but his theory that they can't be, that was something I remember that got talked about for years over dinner, and so many households after this movie came out was like, you know, do you think it's possible? And, you know, I do think it's possible, but you can't ignore the sexual tension or the sexual possibilities or whatever. You can't ignore that part of it. If you ignore that part of it, it'll become a problem. But I think that if you acknowledge it, then, but yeah, it's something that does affect most relationships in one way or another. And I do kind of wish that as men we didn't have such one-track minds. Not to generalize, but you know, in some ways it's dependable, but in other ways it gets in the way of a lot of possible, you know, relationships. You know, so I get what he's saying.
Right. Right. I mean, I think he's somewhat joking. He's like half joking with what he's saying here.
Oh yeah.
But she, you can see that she's a little insulted by it, by having him
Yeah.
make a comment like that, even though she doesn't want the other response either. You know, she's not interested in having a relationship with him. So, you know, the fact that he says it this way is just very funny. You
Yeah,
know,
and I
the way
like
that.
her, yeah, her sarcastic, "That's wonderful, Harry." Like,
Exactly.
good for you.
Right. And then the scene changes and we get another one of these documentary couples telling their story of how they got together. So what I found really interesting, and this I only found out because I was listening to the commentary of who this man is. Okay.
Oh.
Now, I mean, you can go into IMDb and find their names. You know, his name is Bernie Hearn, and her name is Rose Wright.
Bernie
Okay.
Hearn and Rose Wright. What a couple of names. I love it.
Yes, but because I listened to the commentary, I actually know who he is. First of all, she has absolutely no other Bernie Hahn. Sorry, she has no. Oh, Bernie Hearn. Sorry, I'm sorry, Bernie Hearn. She has no other credits on IMDb, and I did a search. I couldn't find anything about her. Okay,
Right.
but Bernie Hearn apparently was Carl Reiner's one of his best friends,
Oh, okay.
and the two of them knew each other doing comedy, you know, up in the Catskills, you know, in the 30s and 40s. And Bernie Hearn was the best man at Carl and Estelle Reiner's wedding
Nice.
on the 24th of December, 1943.
Ooh, Christmas Eve. It's a
Yes.
good time to get married.
Yes. But it's very interesting the fact that, you know, that I never would have known this had I not, you know, heard that on the commentary. So I actually went in and changed it on IMDb. So now anyone who goes on IMDb can
Oh.
look and they'll say, "What do you mean? It's on IMDb." But yes, it is because of me. I put it there.
Excellent.
know, so that anyone else will find this out by not having, they won't have to, you know, they won't have to listen to the commentary to hear that information about it. So Bernie Hearn was born in 1915 on November 4th, and he passed away on November 2nd, 2 days before his birthday in 1997. So he passed away at the age of 81, just a few days short of 82. On IMDb, he only has 13 credits. Not very, I guess he was more of a you know, he was working on stage
Right.
more than anywhere else. He One of his most prominent roles was on six episodes of LA Law between 1986 and 1991. He played a
Oh,
judge.
my gosh, who wasn't on LA Law? I feel
That's
like
right.
everybody did a couple days on LA Law back in the day there.
Yes, he played Judge Sidney Schroeder in
Sidney
six
Schroeder.
episodes. So that's very fun. So then we'll now get into this whole conversation of what the two of them have, which is this is a fun documentary couple. I mean, I love them all. I think they're all great, but it's fun looking at them and trying to figure out what type of relationship these people apparently have. Okay, and the way that this conversation goes is also great because, you know, they keep interrupting one another and interjecting. While the other is trying to tell parts of the story. So
I
it
love
starts
it.
off with the man going, "We were both born in the same hospital." And the wife goes, "In 1921, 7 days apart in the same hospital. We both grew up one block away from each other. We both lived in tenements on the Lower East Side, on Delancey Street. My family moved to the Bronx when I was 10. He lived on Fordham Road. Hers moved when she was 11. I lived on 183rd Street. For 6 years, she worked on the 15th floor. I worked." And then it gets cut off, and people are gonna have to come back on Monday to find out what the rest of that story is. But it's just great that, you know, that the two of them have such amazing chemistry here.
They do, and this is one of those things where I love these interstitials of the old couples talking, because I'd forgotten about them entirely. Rewatching this movie and being asked to do this minute, I was like, "Oh, right!" You know, they had these little act break, chapter break, little documentary sections of the old couples talking, and I thought it was just a charming motif and such a beautiful little thing to do. But I always wondered, were they old couples or were they actors playing old couples? And I guess what you're saying is that they were actors playing
Right.
old
Well,
couples,
what
right?
apparently the story goes, and I've told this before, but the story goes is that they're real stories. They found real people who tell their stories, and they originally wanted to film the real couples telling the stories, and apparently it was a mess. You know, the timing and everything, the couples just weren't as good. So what Rob Reiner ended up doing was he took the stories and had actors give over these stories to make it a little more dramatic and better, you know, for us
So
to
kind of
catch
a
it.
little bit of a hybrid, kind of a bit of both kind of thing. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, some people, put them in front of a camera. There's no comic
I
timing.
mean,
It's not, even if the
what I
story's
find
good.
annoying is that I've been trying to do research, trying to figure out, you know, where all these stories really came from. You know, if Rob Reiner was able to say, you know, oh, this was this person and this was that person, you know, we have no idea. You know, where the actual story. We know that the first story is based on the story of the parents of a friend of Rob Reiner's, one of the producers of the movie, Alan Horn. That was his father who told. It was the story of his how his parents met. But the rest of the stories, I haven't been able to figure out, you know, who the stories are based on. You know, because if they're all real stories, it would be great to be able to hear, you know, that this is the story of this person or whatever. You know, even if Rob
It's
Reiner were to say, okay, this is another friend of mine's parents, their story, you know, the just even the minimal amount, I would love to hear.
minimal amount. That'd be great. Yeah, I love the style of people talking over each other. I'm a huge fan of it. There's a bunch of movies that do it, and I'm always such a sucker for it because it's so Robert Altman did a lot of it. Like he had a lot of
Robert
people
Altman
talking
was
over.
the one who first started that.
Yeah, because it was always, prior to that, it was always one person talks, the other person talks. And it's not always like that in real life, especially when you get a couple that have been together for 70 years and they're telling the same story they've told 500 times. They become like conjoined twins, just finishing each other's sentences. They're one brain with two mouths kind of thing. And that's what you get in this little bit.
Yeah,
It's
and it
not like
sounds as
that
if this is a
with all the
story that they've
couples.
told hundreds of times to people.
And he's still getting the details wrong,
No, he
goddammit.
doesn't get.
He's
No,
like,
he doesn't. She's not correcting him at all. She's
no,
interjecting
well,
and adding the information. The
she's
previous
adding
couple
information. Yeah.
was the one where the guy couldn't remember the names of all his ex-wives and whatever.
Oh,
And
that's
there, she's correcting him. This, you know, in this case, the woman doesn't correct him at all. She's
No,
just
she's just
interjecting and
adding,
adding, you know,
clarifying.
her side of the parts of that story. You know,
Like
that's
a
it.
hype man in a rap group or something. She's just jumping in with the extra details
Correct.
that are there. But
Right.
I like the way
Right. So they
I
mentioned
just
a
like I just
whole,
love their chemistry.
yeah. They mentioned so many different areas of New York. Okay, I know you're not a New Yorker, but yesterday we talked a little bit about Central Park. Have you ever heard of the Lower East Side? Like, what do you know about the
Oh yeah,
Lower East
no,
Side?
I've been to New York like a few times, so I know part of it, but I'm not a born and bred or anything like that.
Right. So, do you know anything about the Lower East Side?
Is that like Alphabet City? Is that like which is the like what's the I forget what the good part of town is. The Upper West Side the good part and the Lower East is kind of the bad part,
No,
or
I wouldn't say
is
it's a
that the
low.
way?
It's the Lower East Side was known as a historic neighborhood for like many immigrants moved there, and it was a working class neighborhood. My stepfather actually was born there, and he grew up there. In the Lower East Side. You know, so he would always regale me of stories, you know, of stuff that happened there, you know, back in the 30s and 40s and stuff like that.
So that'd be like a family of 10 in a one-room apartment,
There were
working
places
on a
like that, yeah.
building.
There were places like
Sure,
that.
sure, sure. Like you go from Ellis Island to the Lower East Side kind of thing, and then get a
That
job and
did happen often, yeah. Okay, I mean the area was you know, was there for many, many years beforehand. You know, even in the 17th century, there were people that were living in that area at the time. Okay, but when the immigrants started coming to New York in the 19th and early 20th centuries, many of them came to the Lower East Side and they moved into crowded tenements, which is one of the things that they mention here, you know, that they were living in tenements. You know, there were in the 1840s or so, there were a large number of German immigrants that settled in the area, and the area started becoming known as Little Germany or Kleindeutschland.
Kleindeutschland.
Yeah. But then many Italians and Eastern European Jews and Greeks and Hungarians and Poles, Romanians, Russians, Slovaks, Ukrainians, they all came to this area. And by 1920, the Jewish neighborhood was actually one of the largest of the ethnic groupings. There were over 400,000 Jews that were living in the Lower East Side.
That's a lot.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Just in one city.
Mm-hmm. It's one area of the city. This is just the neighborhood. You know, they had pushcart vendors that would be that would all work on Orchard Street and Grand Street. They had Yiddish theaters that were very popular there also. The areas were known as somewhat of slums, but they were far from ideal. When they started creating zoning laws and things like that, things started changing a little bit and becoming a little better for people.
Yeah.
You know, so basically they say that there are many American Jews, apparently myself included, who refer to the area as a special place for where, you know, Jewish people were living, just like people, you know, like Chinatown would be for people of, you know, Chinese backgrounds and descent and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I actually think that my aunt still lives in that area. Yeah, I think she does. So obviously it's no longer tenements, but, you know, things have changed.
No. When I went there for a couple of weeks and I stayed in a place just off of Houston Street, and I don't know, it was converted mm-hmm. tenements that I was living in. It was kind of a nice apartment. I'd done an apartment swap with someone in Vancouver during the 2010 Olympics. And, but yeah, it was like, he'd taken like two tenements and put a spiral staircase between them. And so it was like a two floor, nice enough apartment, but he was like, yeah, it used to be like four apartments with 10 people in each apartment.
Oh, wow.
Kind of thing. You know, it was, it had been upgraded and resold, and there was a Whole Foods across the street or whatever, but this was not the, you know, the origins of the place were not seedy, but definitely crowded with immigrants at one point, 40 or 50 years right. earlier. So I don't know if that was exactly the Lower East Side, but it might have been.
It could have been. I don't know New York geography well enough to be able to explain that to you and figure out where the whole thing, stuff like that. No, but I just think it's great how they're talking. They talk about Delancey Street, you know, which is also, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard or seen the movie Crossing Delancey. You know, it's about a Jewish woman whose grandmother is trying to fix her up with the local pickle guy, you know, and because Delancey Street is a prominent, you know, street of the Lower East Side and stuff like that. Right. So, yeah. So I just thought that's done really well, the way that they, you know, it comes across that these people are a real couple, you know, that they have been together for so long.
Well, that was my whole question. Was I was like, are these actual old couples? Because I totally believe it. There was one of the couples, I think one that comes after this, where I recognized the woman from something, and I was like, oh, I guess they're actors. But they all do such a good job. Yeah, where I was staying on Houston was just a couple blocks away from Katz's Delicatessen.
There you go.
So I guess it was. Yes, it was the Lower East Side.
Lower Manhattan. So, okay, it could be.
Which is, it's in between East Village and Lower Manhattan, not too far away from the Tenement Museum. Oh, I see. No, here we go. It's real close to the Lower East Side, but not quite all the way in.
All right, Tim, anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
Jeez, just right in this little cluster. NoHo, Lower Manhattan, Little Italy, Chinatown, Two Bridges, Lower East Side, East Village, Ukrainian village. Anyway, sorry. about this minute, I do want to say that I like the flashbacks. I thought Billy Crystal with hair is always fun to see. And I really thought that Meg Ryan suited the 70s hair in the beginning. That feathered, like Chrissy from Three's Company, or not Chrissy from Three's Company, Chrissy's cousin, like two roommates later, Cindy.
Cindy.
She reminded me
Okay.
of Cindy from Three's Company with the big feathered blonde hair. Another thing that I liked was that I liked that they didn't waste a bunch of exposition about how the rideshare to New York
Right.
came about,
Well,
you
because
know,
they
or
gave us a
what the
lot to talk
arrangement
about.
was or whatever. It's
We spent a lot of time talking about that.
no doubt, right? Like they're just like, hey, some people do that sometimes. Anyway, it's a road
Right.
trip with strangers or
Exactly.
friends of friends. Like the
Right.
details aren't important. I think a lot of screenwriters would spend time on
Right.
the setup, and it's like it doesn't matter. It doesn't actually matter. And his White Man's Overbite, that bit that he does, that really, whenever I catch myself dancing and I start doing that, I automatically remember this scene and try to stop myself because I'm like, oh God, I'm doing it. I'm doing the White Man's Overbite. I love the story at the baseball game. Don't fuck with Mr. Zero. The t-shirt that says don't fuck with Mr. Zero, I think that's absolutely hilarious. I lived in Winnipeg for a while in an apartment with no furniture, so I spent a day throwing cards into a hat. And it's like in Groundhog
Wow.
Day and here. In Groundhog Day, he says it takes like a day and a half to get really good at it, but I found it took like 2 or 3 hours before I was starting to get like, you know,
I'll take your
50 out
word
of the
for
52 cards in the hat.
it.
Yeah. But I was like, I've got this time, I've got the space, and I literally have nothing to do. So I found that it took shockingly less time than I thought. I've heard that someone does the orgasm thing like every day in Cats's. Every day someone's like starts warming up and doing their fake orgasm like the scene, and then they're like, oh God, here we go again. Jeez. And I guess I just one of my favorite Meg Ryan deliveries is in this movie, and I know we're not there yet, but the what are you saying? You took pity on me? Fuck you! And then slaps Billy Crystal. That was like, it's one of the best FUs I've ever
And
heard in a
it's
movie.
something, I
It
mean, we'll talk
still
about
is
when we
every
get to
time
it,
I
but it's
see it.
something you don't expect from Sally.
Yeah. No. Doesn't you don't see it coming, and it's full commitment. It's not you know, her cute character trying and failing to be edgy. Like it's felt.
Yes.
It is a bone deep you know, FU that I love. And I just really want to do a shout out to Carrie
Yes.
Fisher because I'd forgotten she was in the movie. Because I saw her in like Shampoo and like this like she's in actually a good amount of movies where she's not Princess Leia, but I'm like, I know her, like she's so imprinted in my brain as Princess Leia that it's always wild to see her doing something that's not that. And the chemistry between her and Bruno Kirby is
It works
just
really, really well.
awesome. And I'm sad they're both gone because they really vibe off each other in this beautiful way, and her comic timing is so good when she's going through the Rolodex and she's like married and like you know
Dog ears it.
does like
That's right.
the bookmark fold thing, you know, and like you know, oh, me and Joe broke up, and the one
Which
girl's
is
like, oh, that's horrible, and she's
exactly.
like, Joe's available, like
Yes.
she's so funny, so I just wanted to give a shout out to her, but that's it. And also just that I find that Meg Ryan is like a savant when it comes to acting. Like I thought that a lot of what she portrays on screen and a lot of the magnetism that comes across from her is naturally occurring. Like there's just a fountain in her of kindness and goodness and magnetism that's just there for free. Just turn on the camera and have her talk about something, and it's gonna work. And I find that that's why she works so well with Tom Hanks, is because he's got that same thing. His comic timing is innate. His accessibility is innate. Like, I think that's why a lot of people always, you know, refer to
Right.
him as the next Jimmy Stewart, because there's that everyman quality to him that he's still so captivating. And it's the same with Meg Ryan. I find that she's got that every woman quality as well, where she's attractive but not threateningly attractive, and she's magnetic and hypnotic, and you just want to see her talk some more, you know. But when you put the two of them together in a movie, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, that was like the real winning combo. Because I think Billy Crystal and her, they have good chemistry here, but he's kind of a bit of a jerk, you know. And so there's kind of a, she could probably do
but
better.
But she weans him off of it.
You know, so it's
he
like,
becomes less of a jerk.
She does, and he weans her off of, you know, putting I guess I don't know what you would call that, but what do you call that?
Yeah.
Like the OCD. Like, yeah, it's not all the way OCD, but there's shades of something going on. Like, I kept thinking, is she on the spectrum watching these clips because of the, like, the sort of pedantic way she approaches life. You know, she's very kind of logical and robotic about it, but there's emotions that keep cropping up that confuse her. And I'm like, so I was like, are you human? But anyway.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the script has a few minor discrepancies in the Harry and Sally bit. The main one being is that Harry says, a woman friend? This is amazing. You know, he adds that little line in there. This is amazing. You may be the first attractive woman I have not wanted to sleep with in my entire life. You know, so, you know, that. Yeah, exactly.
I'm kind of glad they changed that. That's not really in keeping with his character to be like, exactly. Oh boy, that's not really Harry's.
Okay. But the style. Documentary footage is completely different. They don't have in the script at this point, at least, this couple. You know, they might appear later. I will keep everyone in suspense to find out when they show up in the script. But according to if and when they show up in the script, but according to the script, this is a completely different thing. And I will now read through what goes through here. So it says a series of quick cuts of different older couples, each of them sitting in a love seat and looking at the camera. The first older couple, she was wearing a white dress with little daisies on it. Second older couple, he had a Borsellino hat. Third older couple, a bright red coat with black buttons. Fourth older couple, a blue suit. He told me after it was the first suit he got from a real tailor. And then fifth older couple, in her hair, she had a white flower, a camellia. So I got to say, I'm glad they cut that. I'm glad they changed it. It just doesn't work. Having each of them just say like the one thing they remember about, you know, what the other one was wearing at the time when they first met.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a really good music video by a woman named Cyn, Cyn. And the song is called I'll Still Have Me. And so it's like, even though we've broken up, I'll still have me. Kind of thing, but it opens with old people being interviewed in an old folks' home about meeting the love of their life or what they think love is about. And so there's like three little interviews that are exactly like the interviews here in this movie of old people talking about, you know, meeting each other and what it was like to be with that person. And so I recommend looking that up and taking a look at it, because it's, if you like the vibe of these interstitials in this movie, you'll like that bit.
Okay, I'll definitely keep that in mind. So every Friday we have a segment called Weekend Romance, where my guests will give their top five rom-coms. So Duncan, what have you got? Start with number five and work your way up.
I couldn't narrow it down to five, you know, and I also became very fascinated with the idea of what is a rom-com, you know, like I think that rom-coms, and you know, you get your very, very classic ones, but like, is High Fidelity.
It's your definition of a rom-com. That's the way I interpret it.
Yeah. So, I got one, two, three, four.
I only
five,
want
six,
five.
Seven, I got nine.
You can give the other four honorable mentions.
Okay, sure. One, two, three, four, five. That sounds good. Okay, so honorable mentions go to Groundhog Day, My Best Friend's Wedding. Because My Best Friend's Wedding just has that moment at the end where she's talking to Rupert Everett and he's like, okay, so he's driving. She's chasing him. You're chasing her. Who's chasing you? She's like, nobody. And so it's like, right. Are you in the right to be doing what you're doing right now? And I've never really seen that in a rom-com before where she was like, oh, I'm actually in the wrong. you know. And and then another honorable mention goes to Moonstruck. I thought Moonstruck is, I lost my wife, I lost my hand, he's got his bride, he's got his hand, I'm supposed to put it all behind me and forget, you know, like he's just amazing in that movie. So okay, top five. Number five,
oh, that's Harold a great Maud. One.
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful movie. Number four, shockingly, recent one, The Big Sick. I thought that was a fantastic movie. Number three was fascinating to me, Shallow Hal.
Mm-hmm. Jack Black.
Jack Black, it's the mm-hmm. power to see past the exterior of women. And I thought that was fascinating because the actresses they got to play the like the hot women that he was seeing, not the mm-hmm. hot women that existed, but the hot women that he was seeing through the lens of the spell that had been placed on him, kind of thing. They were super hot women who had to act like they knew right. what it was like to be unattractive. And I saw that it was a ratio about 30%. Like it was like three out of the five women I thought nailed it. You know, whereas I think like, you know, two of them were like, oh my gosh, you like me? Wow. And I was like, that's not how an unattractive person reacts right. to positive attention. When they've been made fun of their whole life or they're not used to it, they're not just like, a Mayan, you know, like they're very suspicious at first, or they're like, I don't even know what's going on right now. What are you talking about? Like they're not, just like, oh, right. happy day, it's finally happening. And I thought that it was interesting to see these really attractive actresses have to act like they were not attractive. And I thought you can sort of see which ones maybe grew up with buck right. teeth or grew up ugly and then, you know, turned into a swan. I thought that was fascinating. And then number two, My Best Friend's Girl, with Dane Cook, Kate Hudson, and Jason Biggs and Alec Baldwin. I thought that like Jason Biggs was, you know, sort of cast as the sort of hero that we're supposed to be rooting for. And I didn't care about him at all, like at all. The chemistry between Kate Hudson and Dane Cook is ridiculous. Like it just has to be seen to be believed. The two were just meant to be on screen together. And it feels like it was accidental. Like they were supposed to get along and kind of, you know, find love. And I know that the rom-com is supposed to be about them, but I think we were supposed to actually feel sympathy for Jason Biggs. And I don't think there was an audience who did. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then my number one would be Broadcast News.
Oh, wow. That's it.
I've seen that movie so, so many times. I love Broadcast News because it's a rom-com that also, you know, folds in right. the ethics of journalism into it. And it's got just career best performances from, in my eyes, you know, Albert Brooks,
Holly Hunter, and
William Hurt and Holly Hunter, the amazing Holly yeah. Hunter. So I'm in a spell that Patton Oswalt comes in. He's like, you know, I'm going to conjure up the spirit of this and the spirit of that, and we'll use the tears of Holly Hunter. He's like, this, like they're unicorn tears, the tears of Holly Hunter. Now she's, anytime Holly Hunter shows up, I'm just like, oh boy, it's Holly Hunter. But she's really right. good at
practice. Very cool. Thank you very much for that. So do you want to, for one last time this week, tell people how they can get in touch with Duncan Shields?
Yeah, just go to @ByDuncanShields on Instagram or Twitter. And yeah, just look for me at TorontoLogicallySpeaking.com, where we've got the movie by minute breakdown that I did by myself with a host of guests, much like you're doing, for 1982's seminal watermark classic Disney movie Tron. And then me and Courtney Coulson did an episode by episode breakdown of Tron Uprising, and we're currently taking on Tron Legacy, and that will be posted soon. So if you love Tron, all things Tron, go to Tronologically Speaking, and then also go to the Time Bandits Minute, where me and Curtis Blaze take apart the 1980 wonderful Terry Gilliam classic.
Excellent.
Time Bandits.
Very good. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website, movierobminute.com. So, Duncan, thank you again for joining me for the last 3 days. It's been a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed yourself too. I hope all of our listeners
I sure did.
also have been enjoying our conversation about this. And I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, I'll have what she's having.
And I'll have what she's having.
Gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. Had to be you.